Music from Buddy Green. It's an old one, kind of updated for us. Bringing in the Sheaves, we heard from Paul Wilbur. Stand up and give him the praise. We heard from Paul Clark as well. Fly on, sweet angel. And it's 14 minutes after the hour. We're joined this morning by Dr. Don Clark from Garden Valley, Texas. And Don, our resident biochemist and board member at creationmoments.com. And, well, Don, good morning and welcome.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave. It's good morning, to be here.
We're back on Dr. McCullough's website today, and the guy has so much information, and I'm wondering if do we go there too often, do you suppose? I mean, how much credibility do you ascribe to Dr. McCullough and his website?
Well, I think he's quite credible, actually. I mean, he does, he seems to do a thorough, you know, investigation of the things that he puts on his website. Some of them are obviously sensational because that's what we talk about them here on the radio program. But in general, I think he's quite credible.
Well, the pieces are well written, and I tend to give him credibility too. It's just that sometimes you run across websites that zero in on one particular topic. And of course, in Dr. McCullough's case, and I don't know the full range of topics, but genetically engineered food is something that he is quite hot about, isn't he? He's formed some strong arguments against the practice.
Well, that's right, and he's brought several people on. He interviews experts in the field, and if you go to his website, you can actually find those interviews as well, and they're probably on YouTube. But he'll bring experts on the field, and they'll explain exactly what the problem is or the problems are.
Now we'll use this particular article as a link in our podcast of our conversation this morning up on the website a little bit later, so you can actually link to the article to read it for yourself, take a look at the videos. But one of the things Dr. McCullough is talking about here is the erosion and degradation of topsoil. He maintains we have only about 60 years of topsoil remaining, and then it starts to cripple the food supply. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a definitely a concern, and how does one link topsoil degradation to genetically engineered crops? We know that farming techniques, in particular using synthetic fertilizers as well as the deep tilling of the soil, destroys the topsoil. But here he's specifically talking about, and the expert that he brought in is specifically talking about DNA vectoring of the genes that have been inserted into the corn, for example, or soybean. And those genes being transferred to the soil microorganisms, and thereby changing the bioflora of the soil.
And incidentally, this is worldwide, not just in the United States. In fact, there's an article on the page about a group of scientists from the Indian Council of Agricultural Research that apparently have been found guilty of infecting and it says subsequently hiding the fact that indigenously created BT cotton contained a Monsanto gene. It's as if they're super anxious to get all this genetically engineered stuff into production without the public knowing it as a whole. And of course, Dr. McCullough and others find fault with this practice, and Monsanto takes a lot of the blame, don't they?
Well, they do. Unfortunately, in this case, with the Indian scientists, they borrowed the gene, or I should say stole the gene from Monsanto, from some of their crops. And then, of course, duplicated the gene and inserted it into their own crops. And so the scientists are being prosecuted for, one, hiding the fact that they were doing this, and two, for stealing the gene, from Monsanto. And if all of this was innocuous, you just have another genetically modified, plant or crop that doesn't do anything to the environment. But apparently
it's like playing with fire. I mean, they don't understand the ramifications, the fallout from this years down the line. and not only with respect to topsoil, but to the health of people and animals as well.
That's correct. And yeah, to go back to the topsoil, the main problem with the genetically engineered products, as I said, was in order to get a gene into a cell, you use a technique that's called vectoring. So you attach to the gene another piece of DNA or a virus, particle that allows allows you to insert or inject, if you will, on a microscopic basis, the gene that you want to introduce to the plant cell, in this case. They have subsequently found that those vectors are still available in the plant that you're growing, and they kind of leak out of the cell, leak out of the plant, in particular in the root system, and those then infect for example, the fungus that you have, the natural fungus and the bacteria that you naturally have in the soil. Now, that wouldn't be, all that bad, except that you now introduced an artificial gene into these microorganisms, and it completely disrupts the diversity of microorganisms in the soil. So you wind up with, instead of, millions or so different types of microorganisms, you wind up with a very select group of microorganisms, which then have a very select, function in the soil.
And the problem with that being, you can't predict what's going to happen, whether next year or 10 years or 20 years or 50 years down the line.
Well, that's right. And it degrades, it degrades the quality of the soil because you don't have the diversity anymore, the microdiversity that was there naturally. And the soil is made up, obviously, of sand and clay and various other, decomposing organic matter. But more importantly, it's made up of all of these microorganisms, the fungus, the beneficial fungus, the nematodes, the bacteria actually, for example, certain types of bacteria convert nitrogen into fixing it into nitrates that the plant then takes up as nutrient into the plant. Well, if those bacteria are damaged either through this vectorization or through the glyphosate, which is a totally different problem, but the plants that are genetically engineered or engineered for two purposes. One is to not be injured as much with glyphosate, which is, of course, a herbicide. And so you have all of this, diversity being kind of shut down, and you wind up with less fertile soil in the end. And that therein lies, the problem with
in his conclusion, it takes 10 to 40 times, it's disappearing at 10 to 40 times the rate that we can replenish it, because it takes decades or even centuries to regenerate significant levels of soil. So not only are we using it up, but there's a link with fresh water use too, and apparently fresh water drains through this stuff and disappears back into the system. And we, in effect, lose the productivity of the fresh water as well. So there are a lot of things linked. This is not a simple system, is it?
Oh, not at all. And, it's all linked. It's all linked together. These microbes are actually kind of glue that binds the sand particles, if you will, together. And instead of creating a nice dense mass, for the soil, it actually loosens it up quite a bit. And of course, with the worms and everything that you normally would have, in healthy topsoil, that the soil then compacts, and the percolation rate through the soil is much different and much less with these modified soils that have been growing the genetically engineered crops.
Well, if I can quote from the article, one sentence here: the latest science seems to suggest genetically engineered plant cultivation may seriously disrupt soil ecology by reducing microbial diversity, which decreases soil fertility over time, possibly irreversibly, meaning we don't recover from this.
Well, yeah, possibly. That's the key, possibly. Yeah,
now, without chemical companies and science finding some answer to reverse what they've just done to us.
Or using organic techniques where you actually, go in with naturally produced compost and compost teas and putting back carbon into the soil, but that's much more expensive had you done the thing right in the first place.
If we were still a nation of small farmers, individual farms, would we still have this problem? There's this notion that this is kind of the Jeffersonian notion of the yeoman farmer here, but not politically. I'm just talking ecologically. If we were all on small plots, is there enough land to go around to do that, to feed the population of the earth in that way? Or do we need these big farms and these chemicals?
Well, we don't need these big farms. We don't need these these chemicals. You don't need the chemical pesticides and the chemical fungicides that are being applied, on a commercial basis. The small farmer was doing quite well, and unfortunately, the large farms, overtook the small farms, and the small farmer couldn't make a go of it because of the overhead cost and, of course, lack of labor, and so you had to mechanize, and of course, machines are extremely expensive. But the small farmer was more inclined to do traditional farming. That is, the way you fertilize your field is you take manure and you spread it out on your field, and that then becomes, your source of nitrogen and other. Not only are you spreading organic matter on your field, but you're spreading these microbes on your field as well, and you're feeding them. So you're building up the soil in that way, as opposed to tearing it down, which we're doing today.
You know, I was watching the Super Bowl last night, and one of the ads was by that's typical of Super Bowl ads. I can't remember the advertiser. Who was it? I want to say Jeep. But it was focused on a Paul Harvey story, and it had Paul Harvey's voice talking about why God made the farmer. And I'm sure he's long gone to us now, but it's probably 30, 40, maybe even 50 years ago that this was recorded. And it paints a very noble picture of the small farmer. That's why God made the farmer is the recurring phrase in the whole thing. And the importance of the farmer, the centrality to our way of life struck me. Also, that God made the farmer. Not somebody else, not corporate powers, not science, not man's own genius, but God gave us the farmer. And worldwide, is there still small individual agriculture that you're aware of practiced anywhere in the world?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, in developing nations, it's practiced. That's the technique for the most part.
Okay, so there are examples of that yet of people succeeding to feed themselves that way.
Right. And, yeah, you can find it in, Central America. Of course, you have your big farms, too, but you can find it in, in those countries. You can find it in Africa. That is the main type of farming, these days. There's plantations, but the way most people live is they're farming themselves in order to, be able to... grow crops and to eat. And we have definitely gotten away from that practice as we take people out of the country and put them in the cities to do service type work. I think we've not only are destroying our land, but because of these practices we've been talking about, but we've lowered the quality of life, for people. Because there's something, you know, there's something about being on, you know, open land and working the land and you know, of course, those areas that have sun, going out and enjoying the sunshine as well as, you know, doing a good day's work in the, in that manner. Yeah, there's something about that. And, you know, I think God intended us to do those activities.
It's not a simple thing. There are a lot of things that result when a family works its own plot of land. Among them, generations living and working together. You know, two generations, three generations, that's been our history. Not that it's been an untroubled history, but you know, that's beyond the scope of our program today. But, you know, I used to wonder how the Bible would say that in the end times, God cleanses the earth. We get a new heaven and a new earth. And I used to wonder why. What's wrong with the old one? And now I'm beginning to see how far down the road we've taken it. You know, as human beings have failed in the stewardship duties that we have.
Oh, for sure. And then with these techniques that we're using, in quote, you know, modern techniques, and all of the science that we're, you know, that we're using, instead of improving things, we are, you know, causing a degradation in the system, which ultimately, as the article, you know, describes, ultimately could lead to massive, you know, not only, you know, just a massive loss of food for everyone.
Well, starvation, you know, famine, in a lot of areas, you know, of the world, yeah.
Which, of course, you know, the Bible talks about. There will come a time when you know, not only will there be wars and rumors of wars, but there will be famine, you know, across the land.
Is there an organization fighting for the other side to reverse this? I mean, or is that too much to expect? It's because it's about dollars, and that tends to attract a lot of powerful forces fighting for the perpetuation of the dollar flow. You know, whether it's chemical companies or organized science or governments, is there a voice for simplifying still? I mean, is there an organic movement that has any momentum? Are there enough people, enough power on that side to reverse this trend?
Well, yeah, folks are trying. There is our Organic Consumers Fund that folks can donate to, which is all about this labeling effort. At least the first step is to label our foods. What in the world, you know, which foods are genetically engineered and which ones aren't? You know, there's organizations. We talked about Proposition 37 in California. Now there's a petition, I-522 in Washington State, which is a labeling type of, petition, proposition in that state as well. There's one in Vermont, you know, right to know, GMO petition. So it is catching on. There's momentum behind it, and there's, you know, groups that are organizing and websites that you can go to get more information on this. A lot of this is, of course, you know, posted on Arcola's site, so you can find out more information, you know, about that, those type of activities, and get involved.
Well, folks, I mean, who are interested in seeing this article can, one, come to our website later under Audio Archives and go to Don's Conversation from this morning, and you'll be able to link to the article. Otherwise, it's at articles.mercola. That's M-E-R-C-O-L-A, Mercola. Articles.mercola.com, and then you can do a search for topsoil. It'll bring you up all the relevant articles there. And, of course, among the articles we read on his site was the Norwegian study, a 10-year study on the results of genetically engineered corn and soybeans and its effect on the human diet. And as I recall, that mentioned apparently one of the results was a predisposition to obesity, among other things. Fertility is also affected, isn't it, by genetically engineered food?
Well, it is. And the information has been gaining, you know, on that front now for quite some time, and the problem is you know, first showing up in the animals being fed for example, the corn and the soy, the chickens and the cows and the, you know, the sheep and the goats and all our farm animals that are being fed, their fertility rate has dropped significantly. And we can also look, you know, in our country, our fertility rate has of humans here in this country has dropped significantly. And there's links to other countries where that is also happening in conjunction with the introduction of these genetically modified products.
And that happened on large scale, what, 20 years ago, 30 years ago?
It was, well, actually, the first genetically engineered product, I think, was in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. So, 95, 96.
Okay.
And so, the fertility rate started dropping about 3 years later.
Okay. So, we're really just, we've had enough time now. We can start to see some of the results, or at least start to analyze them and see what the results really are. As the findings come in, and lots of that information, and I've got to think it's worthwhile. You can find over at Dr. Mercola's site, mercola.com. We're talking.
Well,
with
it's gotten so serious, at least in the dairy industry, that they are concerned that they're not going to have enough dairy cow replacements due to this the fertility problem. And where the artificial insemination that was once. If you artificially inseminate a cow, obviously, the rate was about 1.2, success rate. So you had to do it a little bit more than just one-on-one to get fertility. But now it's jumped to 1 to 10 to 1 to 20. Mm-hmm. So you've got to try 20 times before you get a hit.
My goodness.
This is a major problem.
David, what are you thinking over there?
Well, I was thinking about it, and I think we talked a little bit before we went on the air about the fertility rate. And yeah, it seems like the fertility rate is one of those things that is dropping across around the world. And you know, and I have not heard anybody suggest why this should happen to everyone at about the same time. And you know, it doesn't sound like fertility rates are dropping in Indiana, so we can localize or isolate the problem, but it seems to be happening around the world, and nobody's made any direct conclusions or any direct statements. And yeah, I've always been puzzled by that. I've read a number of things, a number of articles, like the Mercola article. Are we missing a smoking gun yet? Is that why people are not accepting the knowledge, or is it? Are there very, very expensive public relations outfits out there, you know, supplying misinformation, making sure that Monsanto stays in business? That's always a puzzle. I look out there in the world and see what supposedly are problems, and a lot of other people looking the other way and saying, well, we got to keep going because I got this 9-to-5 to protect.
Well, it sounds like the evidence is starting to accumulate, and we can only hope that we have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, huh, Don?
Well, that's correct. If you go on the link that we'll provide on the program, there's a Dr. Don Hubbard who actually Dr. Mercola interviewed. He explained some of the difficulty in bringing this information to light because the research is not being funded by the government, and even if it's funded by the private individuals, it's hard to find research institutions that will actually do the research, because of their link, supposedly, to either, being influenced by Big Pharma or being influenced by the government, who's been influenced by Big Pharma, to not bring this information to light. This is obviously extremely, extremely dangerous and is not helping anybody. So you have to go to, just like in the news today, I mean, you have to go to secondary, tertiary sources in order to find you know, good information about these problems.
And there is a video on Dr. McCullough's site, What We Are What We Eat. And you might want to, it's a good one too. It has to do with this burning desire we have for cheap food. I think you'll find it interesting at Mercola.com. And again, we will include the link to that page in our podcast of our conversation this morning. Dr. Don Clark is, a board member at creationmoments.com or Creation Moments. You can reach them. You can learn more about them at creationmoments.com. And, of course, you can link to them from our website on brokenroadradio.com. Don is with us just about every Monday morning. And, Don, we always appreciate it. It's a delight when you come by. And thank you for the information. We're properly scared to death.
Well, I didn't mean to do that, but hopefully we, you know, so some folks will actually take some action on this.
What Jim is kind of referring to is that my newscast last hour didn't scare anybody. I didn't have any.
It was kind of a wishy-washy, mamby-pamby newscast.
Very pansy newscast.
Soft stuff. It's just
very wussy, and I didn't have any stories about worldwide catastrophe or wars breaking out or none of that stuff. It was just, and so you filled a very, very dire need. And
Don, we're so
scared us to death.
We're so grateful for that. Yes.
Can I squeeze in one more? Already started the music.
Well, I've already pressed the magic music button. So,
Okay.
Why don't you go ahead? Go ahead. What's your thought?
Okay. I know people that are starting small farms, that are going back to small farms, but it's not to make a living, it's to feed themselves and their families. And, you know, because of the price of food in grocery stores and those kinds of things. And you know, admittedly, it's a very small number. I bought some fresh eggs last week that, you know, the guy's got half a dozen chickens, and there's no way he can eat all the eggs that they lay over the course of a week. So he's looking for customers. I wonder if there are more and more individuals that want to go back to the land to start to grow. And I'm looking out at my back 40. If I cleared all those trees, I could probably grow a little patch of something. It's not necessarily destroying all the land, but just land that's heavily used right now. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
The big
well, which is all of the normal all the farming land, you know, that where the trees have been cleared, because, you know, let's face it, this country was full of trees at one point in time, so the traditional, you know, farming land and the farming belt, as well as in California, you know, other parts of the country and the world, that land is slowly being degraded, or quickly being degraded. So,
sure, but I mean, I'm talking about my back 40, or the friend of mine that started a small hobby farm in order to just feed his family, and, you know, he still keeps his day job and works the farm in the afternoons and weekends.
You know, that was a movement back in the 70s too. Remember Mother Earth News magazine and all back the hobby farms and fending for yourself and getting dropping out of the cash economy. Didn't work for me.
Buying AA batteries and ammunition.
Caves and AA's, I think, is in
that's
our future.
Right.
Yeah. And your own chicken. A chicken or two. It's not a bad idea. Don, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Be blessed. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, thank you.